Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom. In this show, as the Britain Stronger in Europe team launched their campaign to stay in the European Union, LBC gets reps from both sides to battle out on air. Newsbeat reports on how those Back to the Future-inspired hoverboards are actually illegal to ride, and how are robots affecting the economy? Share Radio Explore. First, the latest global headlines from the AP newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. It looks like things are back to normal at Southwest Airlines, though it's still trying to get some delayed passengers onto airplanes after yesterday's technical problems. Our Sagar Magani has the latest.
The airline says it has fixed the technical issues that caused hundreds of delays yesterday. It had been telling passengers to be at the airport 2 hours early and to print boarding passes at home. Asked if the same advice still holds, a spokesman said passengers should expect a normal day.
Southwest hasn't said what caused the problems that affected its website, mobile app, phone centers, and airport check-in systems. The Washington Post is blasting Iran's conviction of a Post reporter accused of espionage. Jason Rezaian's conviction is an outrageous injustice, says the Post. Our Adam Schreck is overseas with what Tehran is saying.
The judicial spokesman has confirmed there's been a conviction. He's also confirmed there's a possibility of appeal within 20 days. Beyond that, we don't know what sort of sentence Jason could be facing or anything beyond that.
The Post says it's working with Rezaian's family and lawyers on that appeal. An off-duty Memphis police officer's been shot and killed, and a neighbor's been charged with a firearms violation. Karen Lax lives in the neighborhood.
He shot that man, a man that lived here trying to protect us. Mm-hmm. And it made no sense to me whatsoever.
She spoke to WMC TV. Officer Terrence Ulrich was 31 years old. Police are not providing any details, nor are they saying whether more charges will be filed in the officer's death. An Alaska Airlines jet has made an emergency landing in Buffalo after a fire in the galley. Everybody's okay. A credit card reader caught fire, they say, and the crew put out the fire with a fire extinguisher. The Dow's up 9 points. This is AP Radio News. Today is Columbus Day, a federal holiday, though it's also Indigenous Peoples Day in at least 9 cities for the first time this year, including Albuquerque, Portland, Oregon, St. Paul, Minnesota, and Olympia, Washington. Don't talk to Native American activist Nick Estes about Christopher Columbus and Columbus Day.
What he represents is the legacy of genocide and the colonization of Indigenous peoples, and to celebrate Columbus is to celebrate genocide.
Columbus Day supporters say the holiday celebrates centuries of cultural exchange between America and Europe and commemorates an iconic explorer and honors Italian Americans, a group that has endured its own share of discrimination. Visitors to the Houston Zoo can now pack a little something extra besides the camera and the picnic basket. The zoo's lifted its firearms ban as gun rights advocates campaign for zoos in Texas and elsewhere to do the same. They say zoos are illegally posting signs. Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
Today, the Britain Stronger in Europe launched their campaign to keep the UK in the European Union. LBC put up the campaign against Leave.eu, their opposition.
I understand Lord Rose will tell me it's my patriotic duty to stay in the Union later today. Why? Good morning.
Hi. Well, Britain is stronger, we're safer, and we're better off as part of Europe. So there are loads of reasons.
Yes, but I understand I'll be told it's my patriotic duty. I'm intrigued by that. Why is it my patriotic duty?
He won't tell you it's your patriotic duty. He's making the point about it being a patriotic thing that he's done in taking the reins and leading this campaign, because it's about the future of Britain and what is best for this country, and that is to remain as part of the largest market in the world, where half of our exports go, with all of the social benefits and all the other benefits that come with it.
So the exports would stop?
Absolutely not, and nobody's suggesting they were.
So I thought you just said it's where our exports go.
Yes, it is.
So will they or won't they stop?
I'm not saying that they would go. I'm telling you.
So we've got no problem there. So where is the problem then with coming out?
Because we don't know what out would look like.
That's as good as you've got.
Well, many major investors here have said they would reconsider their investment. Take the car industry. 700,000 people are employed in this country due to the car industry. And major companies like Nissan and Honda and Toyota have all said they would reconsider their investment here. When there's a potential threat, to your export market, why would you walk away from that? And it's not Europe or the rest of the world. There's this stupid idea that because we're in Europe, we're being held back. Actually, we have free trade deals with over 50 countries in the rest of the world, thanks to Europe, and they would go overnight if we were to walk away. So I think we need to get it a bit in balance here and think about what the benefits are, not just the costs.
Well, that is quite something. Let's put that to Richard Tice, from co-founder of Leave.eu. 700,000 jobs possibly at risk, Mr. Tice. You can't dance away from that, can you?
And I'm not, and let's be clear, Lucy's completely wrong. The reality is the chief executives of both Vauxhall and Nissan in the last 2 months have stated that leaving the EU would make no difference to their UK businesses or their UK investment plans. She needs to get herself up to date with
Let's put that. We don't have a problem with Nissan and others, Lucy Thomas, so perhaps you're misinformed.
Well, that's not right. The companies that I quoted have absolutely been on record talking about this, as have the SMMT, the umbrella organisation for all of the car manufacturers in this country. Those 700,000 jobs linked to the car industry, you look at what they say, about 90% of their members have all said we're better off as part of Europe, and they would be under threat if we left.
But let me just ask you this, Lucy Thomas. If we are quite good at making cars, and it's fantastic for all the men and women employed doing it, why would people not want us to continue to make their Nissans and Land Rovers and Jaguars? I don't understand.
It's about the conditions into which you're exporting them. So it's really simple. About half of cars go to the rest of Europe, but they have to comply with the standards and the rules in order to do that. At the moment, we're at the table and we're helping to set what those rules are. If we leave, we still have to comply with those rules, but we're out of the room. We get no say over what they are.
Lord Rose will also talk about figures that show that each household in the land would be £3,000 a year worse off under a British exit. How does he get to those figures? Do you know?
Yep, the £3,000 per year are the global benefits broken down per household from the Confederation of British Industry. So these are the benefits like lower prices. Companies like EasyJet, for example, were allowed to set up thanks to EU deregulation, smashing open the markets. It's been really good for the consumer, lowering prices. Also within the £3,000 investment in things like our poorer regions, investment in research and everything that makes Britain's economy stronger.
Mr. Tice, you didn't share those figures with me. £3,000.
Well, it's just simply not the case. I mean,
Business
of Britain came out with a big report recently that shows it's actually almost £1,000 a year better off for every household by leaving in the EU. You can't be better off if you're actually having to send £15 billion a year, £350 million a week, approximately, to the EU. You get some regional grants back, but that's after the EU has taken off their huge administration and bureaucracy costs and send lots of the money elsewhere.
You failed to talk about. Britain gets its own special rebate, which you failed to talk about. And just you really can't guarantee what out is. You can speculate about all of these figures. We know what the benefits are for being in. You can't tell me what it would look like the day after we left.
Members of the EU, but they're very successful economies. Most developed countries around the world are not members of the EU and they are very successful. The suggestion that we can't stand on our own two feet as the fifth largest economy in the world is simply nonsense. And the EU has a legal obligation to agree a new trade agreement with us.
But do you know what? They decide what that deal is and we're out of the room. Yes, they do. Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, read it.
We just operate under World Trade Organization rules, which, remember, sits above the EU and actually organises now many of the international trade standards.
WTO has nothing to say about services, and that's 80% of our economy. If you want to take a gamble on that, good luck to you, but I don't.
Lastly, Lucy Thomas, it's your campaign, or the campaign Lord Rose is heading, that launches today, and among the supporters are Gordon Brown, someone who supported the EU and a loose woman, or loose women. Is that is that as good as in the TV show? Is that the best you got?
Oh, good heavens. So as well as Lord Rose, who ran one of Britain's best-known businesses, M&S, for years, we've got Karen Brady from The Apprentice.
Yes, who's been quoted having doubts about the EU, by the way.
Yeah, but listen, it's not perfect, as has Stuart Rose.
You've got supporters of the euro, the currency, some people who wanted the euro. I don't think we really want to listen to them, do we? Lord Mandelson et al.
Listen, that is not on the ballot paper here. That was a
theoretical
question.
No, but he was a ferocious supporter of the single currency. Look where that might have landed us,
well,
Lucy.
He said just last last week. He's no longer in favour of us joining. None of us are. This is absolutely not the question that we're asking here. We've got loads of really diverse, interesting people. We've got Richard Reid, the founder of Innocent Drinks.
Yes.
We've got Caroline Lucas, former leader of the Green Party. Brendan Barber, who used to lead the TUC.
TUC General Secretary.
The head of the National Union of Students, because this is about their future. It's about young people and their opportunities.
Well, we must just thank you very much. I'll say goodbye. Richard Tice, can you give us an idea who the people supporting your campaign, just so we have a degree of balance?
We've got a very impressive list of business leaders, you know, multimillionaires like Jim Mellon,
yep.
like Aaron Banks, like Lord Calms, you know, lots of great names. But it's actually about the people. It's a non-political campaign. It's about the people because it's one person, one vote. Finally, I would just say it's interesting that Lord Rose found it so difficult to trade in the EU that he took M&S out of France. And yet he's now saying that actually trading in the EU is really easy.
Jealous of all those people on hoverboards? Well, now it turns out those smug faces will have to deal with the possibility of being arrested. Newsbeat Explore.
Met police say that no matter how cool you look riding a hoverboard, it's still illegal. From the Next Web in Ben Woods. Gliding gracefully down the street without expending any energy on a hoverboard might sound like the answer to urban commuter woes, but the Metropolitan Police in London have taken to Twitter to point out that your purchase is basically pointless. According to current legislation, the fact that the hoverboards have an electric motor to drive the wheels makes them subject to the same regulations as other road-going vehicles. Unfortunately, as the self-balancing scooters are classed as a vehicle, it's an offense under the Highways Act to ride them on the pavement too. That means that about the only place you can use a hoverboard is on your own land or inside your own house. The Guardian reports that the guidance, which was initially released for Segway scooters, points out that since self-balancing scooters are powered vehicles, they are illegal to ride on the pavement under Section 72 of the Highway Act, 1835. In Scotland, where the Act does not apply, they are still illegal to ride on the pavement. The scooters are also illegal to ride on the road because they don't meet the requirements to be registered under either the European or British schemes for road-legal vehicles, The Guardian says. Although the regulations have not been changed, a recent resurgence in use of hoverboards prompted the police on Sunday to tweet a warning about their legality to prospective buyers, according to The Guardian. But despite the legal guidance, the hoverboard fad is going from strength to strength, according to The Guardian.
Robots are becoming more and more important in our day-to-day lives. But how are they affecting the economy? Share Radio, find out.
This week we're looking at the robotics world and how they're impacting on our economy, whether in employment, financial advice, healthcare, or the defence industry. Robots are gradually becoming a part of our everyday life. And to kickstart the week, we're looking at the economy and how they impact on it. Robots, that is. Here's Joe Aldridge.
Whether computers operating beneath a supermarket self-service checkout or a mechanical arm in a manufacturing plant, robots already play a part in our lives, often without us even realising. And many now see the ever-developing technologies as a way of reshaping our economy. But just how have they developed? Guy Michaels is an associate professor at the London School of Economics and the co-author of a report on robots at work. And he says we're already witnessing big changes.
One of the big changes in the last few decades is that robots really have developed in terms of their capacity for autonomous movement in three dimensions. And that opens up new possibilities for production. The other big change has been that the quality-adjusted prices of robots fell a lot. So over the period we're looking at, it fell by around 80%. And that led to an increased use of robots, what we call robot density. That's the robots used per hour worked. That increased by 150%.
And Guy explains how these changes can impact on the economy in terms of production and GDP.
And the main impact that we see is a big effect on value added, on productivity. So robots can account for, on aggregate, roughly 15% of the labor productivity growth over this period and roughly 10% of the GDP growth. These are substantial effects. We also see consumers benefiting because robots reduce output prices. At the same time, there is, quite interestingly for us, no overall effect on total employment.
Well, the thing that we know for sure is that countries that can deploy more state-of-the-art equipment, like robots, and that can take advantage of innovation, can deploy innovation, their productivity grows faster, and that directly means their economies grow faster.
That's Stian Westlake, Executive Director of Policy and Research at innovation charity Nesta. Among the criticism often reported about robots, mainly due to their potential impact on jobs, Steen thinks we'd be silly to overlook them.
I think it's a real mistake to overlook the huge benefits that robots bring us. They make our life easier and they make society richer. If you ask yourself, well, what is the point of the economy and of economic growth? It's really about improving productivity, meaning that for every hour of work you or me or anyone else puts in, that society gets more, that we get more goods, more services. And one of the best ways of doing that is by deploying new technologies and deploying capital. And robots are a great example of it. Our factories with robots are more efficient. Our supermarkets with automated checkouts are more efficient. And that means that society as a whole gets richer. It's just the transitional effect. The how do you get from here to there with the jobs question that's more sensitive.
But who are the leading nations when it comes to robots in the economy? I asked LSE's Guy Michaels.
So in terms of robot density, so if you look relative to the hours worked, Germany is still kind of the biggest player in this regard. Robots are moving on and into Asian economies in an important way as well. Nowadays, China is becoming a very big buyer of robots, not on per capita but on an absolute level. And within countries, you definitely see that the industries that adopt robots are the ones that tend to do better in terms of economic performance.
Even though the UK may not be right at the top of the list in terms of robot contribution to the economy, Steen Westlake does point out a noticeable trend that could further shape robotics.
One of the trends is robots moving out of the factory and into the rest of the world. So if you talk to, say, a bunch of manufacturing execs about robots, they'd say, well, what's new? Robots have been around for decades. You know, if you go to any modern car factory, you'll see robot arms, and those technologies have been there for a long time. What's more interesting is robots and automation and computers more generally breaking into more and more parts of the economy. It happened to, for example, supermarket supply chains in the 1990s, transformed that industry. What's going to be really interesting is seeing, for example, it moving into logistics and trucking with self-driving cars, or moving into fields like law firms with computers that can analyze legal documents and require fewer lawyers to be used. It's that moving from the factory into the other bits of the economy that I think is an interesting trend.
And Steen believes we have reason to feel optimistic about further robotic developments in the future.
In short, robots in the economy is something we should be optimistic about. It won't be a painless process necessarily, and we do have to think about how we make sure there's opportunities for everyone and that we don't face an unemployment crisis. But on the whole, bringing more technology and more innovation to bear on the economy will make things better for us as citizens and as consumers.
Joe Aldridge there on what robots mean to the economy. And you can hear about different areas of robotics and the economy throughout this week at 8:30. Tomorrow we'll be covering the most talked about area as we look at robots and how they affect jobs.
And discussing the latest news, here's the Pacey The Briefing from London's Midori House and Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up in the programme, we'll get the latest from Turkey as the weekend's tragic double bombing in Ankara starts to have real political ramifications for the government and its upcoming election. Then we'll hear why a diplomatic spat between Russia and the UK about the capabilities of RAF fighter jets has more dangerous undercurrents than simply discussing weapons. And later in the show, we are off to Südtirol with Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé. All that's right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. So once again, we have a busy show ahead, but first let's have a flick through the North American front pages with Monocle's Daniel Tricapelli. How are you doing this Monday, by the way?
Very good. How are you, Markus?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. The Wall Street Journal, they lead with both Belarus, the presidential election there, whose outcome I'm sure is not very,
surprising.
Surprising. And also, of course, this terrible terrorist attack in Turkey, in which almost 100 people died. So they're leading with both those stories. They have this great photo of the Belarusian presidential election of three soldiers peering out of a voting booth wearing their uniforms. It's not surprising who they're voting for. Also in the Wall Street Journal, you would love this. There's a brief story here about craft brewers in America who are putting really weird things in their beer. I was talking with Tom Edwards about this before. Things they're putting in their beer: broth from a caramelized moose's head, bull testicles, grasshoppers, and a pinch of yeast from a beer maker's beard. These are all going in beer.
So, Danny, when you're in the US, back at home, the next time I go to taste some bull testicle beer.
Yeah, totally, totally. Washington Post has a story about Richard Nixon. Essentially, a new book has come out about his more lying that he did back when he was president. They call him a paranoid, vengeful president. Also, the dangerous decadent parties just down the street. This is a story the Washington Post has about suburban households who are throwing parties in their houses for clubs to pay off their mortgages, essentially.
Tell me more. That's a very clever entrepreneurial concept, isn't it?
Yeah, so clubs who close down early, they basically just do the after party at suburban households. Of course, the neighbors aren't that happy about it, but they make a lot of money from this.
I bet the neighbors haven't been consulted.
No, I don't think they've been consulted. And just finally, the New York Times, they have a story on this Benghazi panel in the U.S. and how it's evolved over the course of about a year and a half from being focused on the attack in Benghazi to now Hillary Clinton's emails, essentially, is now the focus.
That was Monocle's Daniel Tocopelli with today's North American front pages. Thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Torontosta, Lontosta, Zurichista.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
To Miami, to Detroit, to Montreal, to Quebec.
A Barcelona, a Zurigo, a Roma, a Milano.
This is Monocle 24. Broadcasting around the world, around the clock.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
こちらはモノクル24です。
From London, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to The Briefing. 4 minutes past the hour. Let's continue now with the day's top business news. I'm joined by Tom McKenzie of Bloomberg TV. Welcome to the program. Shall we start with some tech news?
Yeah, absolutely. Big news for Dell. It's expected later today to announce that it's buying the data storage provider EMC. This is a deal that's worth around $53 billion and would be the largest ever tech merger, and it would create a corporate computing giant. For those who don't know, EMC makes software and hardware for storage products used in data centers, and fans of the deal say that it would complement Dell's server business, which companies rely on for their computing tasks. Dell, which was taken private in 2013, could use the combination to expand its product lineup in things like data storage equipment. It could also lure customers, importantly, away from rivals like Hewlett-Packard. Possible downsides to the deal: decision-making companies this huge could be pretty slow and cumbersome, as could speedy product development. Those are a few things some of the critics are looking at. That deal is expected to be confirmed in the next few hours.
Well, in other news, mining giant Glencore is going to put some more assets up for sale. Do you think this is going to put an end to speculation over the health of this Swiss firm?
Yeah, well, they will certainly be hoping so, but most analysts expect not. This is part of a big plan that the CEO unveiled after concerns about the commodity giant's balance sheet and its debt load. So basically what they're doing today, what they've announced, is that they're in talks to sell two copper mines in Australia and in Chile. It's the latest move. The company is planning to cut $30 billion. It's got a debt load of $30 billion, so let's get that down to $20 billion. It has mine and metal plants in Australia's New South Wales. It's putting that up for sale. It's also offering up an open-pit copper mine in Chile's Atacama Desert. Analysts don't expect to get it to get more than about $400 million from these parts of the business. So just a drop in the ocean, really, compared to that $30 billion debt pile. And as I said, Glencore's under pressure to show it can get these debts down. It's been hit by falling metals prices.
Well, let's finish today with some car business news. Ferrari's IPO will make the founder's son a billionaire. Do you know the numbers? Just how much is he going to be worth?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, this is good news for him. Amid all the VW, Volkswagen controversy we've been hearing about over the last few weeks, some good news for the auto sector, particularly for one man, and that is Piero Ferrari, the son of the founder Enzo. He's expected to get a fortune of around $1.3 billion when the Italian company lists on the stock exchange. That's according to Bloomberg data. As I say, he's the son of Enzo, who built the company's first racing car in 1947. Most of his fortune will come for a 10% stake he has in the company. The Ferrari brand is currently owned by Fiat, but the Italian auto company Fiat wants to spin it off to help fund an investment program in some of those other brands, Jeep, Alfa Romeo and Maserati. So certainly good news for Piero Ferrari.
That was Bloomberg's Tom McKenzie. Thank you very much. You are listening to The Briefing. Turkey is in mourning today after bomb blasts ripped apart a peace rally in Ankara on Saturday, killing over 100 civilians. While a group has not yet claimed responsibility, public anger is being directed towards the Turkish government, with accusations ranging from Recep Tayyip Erdogan's divisive policies stoking the fire of extremism to outrage at the failings in security at the rally. It doesn't bode well for the country's general election fast approaching on the 1st of November. Our Istanbul bureau chief Chris Lord is on the line now to discuss whether the weekend's events could have an impact on the political makeup of the country. Welcome to the program. What is the latest now? We've heard something from Prime Minister.
Yes, Marcus. In the last hour, the Prime Minister's office has come out and said that they are identifying, or they're saying that this attack has directly come from Islamic State. They haven't got a specific name of a suspect yet, but this is the intelligence that they're revealing now, is that they believe that Islamic State are responsible for the twin attacks that happened on Saturday. I mean, really, at the moment, you know, there was a lots of different fingers being pointed around, whether that was towards the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, whether that was towards a very far left group here in Turkey, or indeed a far right group. So lots of people pointing fingers at each other, and now the PM has come out and said it's Islamic State that is responsible for these attacks.
How do you see the weekend's bomb attacks affecting, well, the public when they think about who they're going to be voting for on the 1st of November?
That's a very good question, Marcus. I mean, I think, you know, we have to look at this in the context of what's happened since June. So in June, there was a hung election here in Turkey, which meant that there was no clear roadmap for the future about who was going to be in parliament. So essentially what's happened now is they've gone back to the polls. And in that interim period since June, you know, Turkey has entered into two different conflicts, one with its old rival, the PKK, this who are essentially Kurdish separatist activists and what they would call terrorists as well. It's gone back into a conflict with them. But also at the same time, it's ramped up its aggression towards Islamic State. It's joined the US coalition against Islamic State. So in the space of only a few months, Turkey is now embroiled in two different conflicts on its borders. Now, on one side, one thing we could argue is that in those months, the sense of uncertainty here and the kind of feeling that the government the situation has become soured and a little bit unclear and a little bit unstable would actually play to the favour a little bit of the ruling party, in the sense that people would surely want to maintain some kind of status quo since before June. So in as much as that might be the case previously, now you see a lot of the electorate here are asking, well, how on earth is it possible that in the centre of Ankara, in the capital city, on a morning there was a possible, you know, there was two terrorist attacks to take place right in the middle of town when it was a legal peace rally taking place. But everybody knew that they were going to gather there at that time. So these attacks this weekend are going to impact, I would argue, quite negatively against the way people are going to be perceiving the AK Party, the ruling party's ability to maintain control and security here in the country.
And what is your feeling? Is there reason to question whether these elections would take place in the beginning of November then?
There is some speculation at the moment about whether that is actually going to be able to happen. Mainly Selahattin Demirtas, who's a leader, the co-chair of one of the opposition parties, has actually, you know, he said there's no more election rallies for his party before November because he said it's just become too unsafe. Other ministers and other leaders as well have talked about this. You know, is it actually going to be safe and securable? Is it going to have some assurances for voters and for political parties to demonstrate or to have any presence? Are they going to feel assured that they can do that in safety? So whether that's, you know, at the moment it's sort of unclear whether they are actually definitely going to happen. The government here says yes, they are definitely going to happen, but there's lots of other voices coming in that are saying, well, we're not too sure if that's actually viable anymore.
And finally, Chris, being in Istanbul, when you walk on the streets over there, what is the feeling over there? Do you see increased security measures, for example?
It's a very good question, that, Marcus. Actually, I was just walking around outside just outside of our bureau here, and just thinking exactly about that. And I mean, really, you know, Turkey is an extremely resilient country. I have to remember that they, you know, have had there's been a kind of constant activity by the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, against the government here for over 30 years. So the idea of sort of terrorist attacks and so on, while this is an extremely deadly and horrible and the worst on Turkish soil in its recent history, what happened this weekend, they're not complete strangers to this kind of violence. So there is a kind of certain mentality of get, you know, kind of carry on and getting on with it. How the government is going to respond now in terms of an on-the-ground security presence is absolutely vital. They need to reassure voters that they're going to respond to what happened this weekend with a full and robust security presence that's going to put them at ease, essentially, for the weeks going ahead before the election. So, yes, to answer your question, at the moment, it's not completely obvious that there's not police combing the streets everywhere, but one would expect that the government is going to have to respond in a robust manner to make people feel safe again in this country.
That was Monaco's Bureau Chief Chris Lord in Istanbul. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is 12:13 here in London, 7:13 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Over the weekend, Russia summoned Britain's defense attaché in Moscow in order to provide an explanation about reports stating the RAF's jets in Iraq are to be equipped with heat-seeking missiles ideal for aerial combat and with a view to possibly shooting down Russian jets. The UK's Ministry of Defense has denied the claims, but there is speculation that diplomatic leaks of this kind are very rarely an accident and perhaps all part of the two countries' information war. A subtle reminder that Russia shouldn't feel too strong in the Middle East region after recent incursions on NATO member Turkey's airspace. Well, joining us now to discuss how these stories reach the media and why they serve a purpose in diplomatic channels is John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay. Welcome to the programme.
Hi.
John, what is your analysis? What do you believe is going on over here?
I think certainly there's an information war underway. The front page of Izvestia, the Russian central Russian newspaper this morning, has prominently displayed a story all about, not this incident, interestingly, but about the story that Russian cruise missiles fell on Iran, which Izvestia clearly believes is part of an American propaganda offensive. It points out that there's no corroboration for this story at all. It looks like the Americans were trying to throw doubt on the accuracy of Russian munitions and to stir the Iranians. What's happened with this latest incident? You said just now that these things are rarely an accident. That's not quite right. I think, you know, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. Sometimes people put these stories out for a purpose. Sometimes they just leak. Somebody just has a few too many gin and tonics and away you go. And I have a feeling that this story may belong to the latter category. There's no obvious diplomatic advantage to the UK, let alone to Russia, in running with this story. It's also highly improbable. As the Russians have sensibly pointed out, there aren't any Russian jets flying around Iraq. They're not there. They're in Syria. So putting missiles on RAF aircraft in Iraq wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. Interestingly, too, the Russian media sourced the story originally not to one of the more responsible British newspapers, but to the Daily Star, a tabloid whose accuracy has been put in question in the past. So it may be that this didn't actually come from a leak at all. It may be somebody's just made it up.
Exactly. And what is normally, what is the routine? Russia, indeed, as I mentioned, summoned Britain's defence attaché in Moscow. What kind of discussions have been had over there?
Well, firstly, they did this on a Sunday. This is unusual. It means you've got to summon the defence attaché on Sunday and you've got to get your own guys into the office on Sunday, which nobody really likes. Shows how jangled Russian nerves are. What happened? Both sides would have been speaking from a script. The Russians have told the world what they said. They asked, what's all this about heat-seeking missiles under the wings of your jet? And the British defence attaché spoke from his script, saying, what on earth are you doing dropping imprecise munitions all over civilian areas and killing lots of innocent people? It doesn't sound much like a meeting of minds to me, but both sides at least got their positions on the record, after which I suspect they went back to their Sunday roast.
And you mentioned earlier that in Russia there's been suspicion that these reports of Russian missiles having fallen on the Iranian ground, that would be a US counter offense in this information war. If we look at that as an example, who is the winner? Why would the US want to throw suspicion over how efficient those missile attacks have actually been?
Because a key theme of the US narrative is that the Russians are not using precision munitions in their strikes, which you are able to actually just take out the terrorists themselves. They are carpet bombing, effectively. They're using World War II technology, and they're using area bombing because they don't have the sophistication. Clearly, showing that even Russian cruise missiles, supposedly a precision weapon, are so inaccurate they can't even hit the right country, feeds this narrative.
How visible is the information war, say, between NATO member countries and Russia at the moment? When you follow what is being said about events happening regarding, say, Syria now, how often do you get a feeling that there may be some other purposes with this information that is being provided or leaked?
Clearly, if a government provides information, it tends to be for a purpose. Some governments will simply provide information just to educate the public in general. But in a situation like this, almost everything is going to get politicized. We just talked about two examples. There's a third. All over the front page of the Russian media this morning, headlines indeed, there's the story that the Toyotas that ISIS are driving around, you know, on which they mount the machine guns, that they all came from America as part of an American campaign to arm the Free Syrian Army. And of course, the Free Syrian Army have now lost these to ISIS. What trumps, says the Russian media.
And just finally, John, Russia summoned Britain's defence attaché in Moscow and discussions were held over there. Well, if the UK says that this news story is not true and Russia believes it, is it then back to the normal or back to the state before this news story?
We like to think so. But frankly, in the heightened state of nerves everywhere at the moment, there are going to be people, especially in the Russian Ministry of Defence, who are going to believe that we, the Brits, are prepared to open fire on their aircraft regardless. So no amount of denials is going to break through that wall of paranoia.
So this news story may still have some kind of consequences in the future. It's not forgotten.
It may do indeed. Let's hope not, but it's possible.
That was John Everard, former British diplomat. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24, and up next we hear why South Africa is withdrawing from the International Criminal Court. It is 19 minutes past the hour, 20:19 in Tokyo, 14:19 in Moscow, 12:19 here in London and 7:19 a.m. in New York City. South Africa plans to withdraw from the International Criminal Court over concerns that the court is biased against African nations. The country's deputy minister, Obed Babela, says that the ICC has lost its directions and that the ruling ANC party wants to withdraw the country from it. Well, joining me now for more is Martin Plaut, a regular Monocle 24 contributor and a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies here in London. Welcome to the programme. Could you give us a bit of background to this new story? Why is it that South Africa and the ruling party thinks that the ICC has indeed lost its direction?
Well, the problem really is that in June, President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan came to visit the African Union summit in South Africa, and he came within a whisker of being arrested under an ICC warrant. There are two warrants by the ICC out for the arrest of President Omar al-Bashir for crimes against humanity relating to the Darfur crisis. And a local organization served an arrest warrant, and the South African government was sort of hard put to find a means of evading this. They were certainly not going to arrest another African leader on their own soil, and they just pretended that he had somehow slipped through their fingers and had escaped through the Waterkloof Air Base instead. Now, that left them, frankly, humiliated. But there's also a strong feeling that the ICC, which doesn't have the United States as a member, nonetheless allows the United States through the Security Council to refer people to the ICC. So they say, well, you know, why on earth does this happen? It's not a balanced situation where you can't take the United States or the United States citizens to the ICC, but they're not members, but the United States can do the opposite. So I think that is part of the reason why there is this groundswell of support for leaving the ICC amongst not just South Africa, but other African nations.
So that is how the ruling ANC party sees the situation. What is your feeling about how the South African public then feels about this issue?
I think they're a bit bemused by it, because the ANC, of course, it is in a difficult position, because if you think about it, in the 1960s, 70s and 80s, the ANC got huge amounts of international backing, support, solidarity for its own fight against the injustices of apartheid. But now they're turning around saying, well, yeah, that was one thing, but you know, now we're many years on, we won't uphold human rights standards. And there was a very strong warning against what the ICC, again, what the ANC is planning to do with the ICC, from somebody who's actually a very senior former member of the ANC, not still a member, but the deputy foreign affairs minister, Aziz Pahad, who warned that it would move the country away from its emphasis on human rights. Now, he's now in retirement, but he's still a very senior figure. And this, I think, will not gel well with some people. But I think amongst the grassroots, to be honest, you know, the issues of unemployment and crime are so high that what's going on in, shall we say, the stratospheric concerns about the ICC will be pretty watered down. And the ANC will get a lot of support, as I say, from the rest of Africa, perhaps the only country that has clear that it will come out in favor of remaining the ICC is Botswana. And the ANC plans to take this to the African Union in January and lead then a mass walkout by African countries of the ICC.
Well, if we think of, say, brand South Africa, other countries following what that one is doing over there, if South Africa indeed was to leave the ICC, do you think this would affect it negatively? Do you think South Africa would be seen in more negative light after that?
I think it will, but it's part of a gradual move of by the ruling party, by the ANC, to move South Africa from being in the center of world affairs and being a sort of balanced participant, where, yes, it had third world concerns, but also was very much part of a sort of Western human rights agenda. And they have gradually, particularly under President Zuma, who one shouldn't forget was trained by the KGB, that he has moved the country in a completely different direction, much closer to the Chinese. They now have an agreement to have political education inside the ANC by people who they're modeling it on the Chinese model of party discipline, party unity, and party instruction. And they have moved South Africa away from that human rights agenda. So, for example, the ANC was very much supportive of Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. They refused to give the Dalai Lama a visa to come and see South Africa. And this has been sharply criticized by a number of people inside South Africa and by magazines like The Economist, which wrote a really scathing review of South Africa's foreign policy, saying they just didn't know where they were going. They couldn't make up their minds whether they were going towards a sort of a third worldist, you know, pro-communist view, or whether they were still within a Western, you know, democratic perspective. And I think there is genuinely a diversion of opinion inside the ANC and inside the South African government. That is what is causing this problem.
And finally, Martin, what would the first steps be then in getting South Africa out of the ICC?
Well, they would have to basically announce that they were leaving. There are procedures within the ICC to do this. And if it was done by the whole of the African continent, if it was an African Union decision basically for everybody to leave, then this would be enormously damaging to the ICC itself. I think that its credibility as an organization would be almost finished, which would be tragic because you have had a number of people now put before the International Court or by special courts which are associated with the International Court, and people like Charles Taylor, although it wasn't the ICC, it was a parallel court, and there has been a beginning of a sense that, you know, international human rights apply to African dictators and to African warlords, and if that is damaged, it would be terrible for Africa and for the people of Africa who began to rely on these initiatives to protect their human rights against some of the worst abuses that are imaginable.
Exactly, and as you mentioned, if South Africa was to leave the ICC, that would be a strike indeed for the organisation. Do you think the ICC can do anything to keep South Africa as a member, or do you think other countries could do something to try to persuade South Africa to actually stay?
I think the only people that really have credibility in this position would be international legal organizations, jurists, maybe the United Nations Security Council. If they asked South Africa to stay, then it might be done, but it's highly unlikely when, you know, given the makeup of things like the UN Security Council, especially when the United States itself does not join, therefore does not submit its own citizens and its own actions to the rigors of the ICC scrutiny. So it could be one can't predict this, but it could be a fatal blow to the ICC's credibility.
That was Martin Plaut, a regular Monocle 24 contributor and a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies here in London. Thank you very much.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
For London, this is Monocle 24.
London より Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Aus New York.
Ob Singapore.
Aus Toronto.
To Hong Kong.
Aus Istanbul.
A Cardiff.
Esta é a Monocle 24.
C'è Monocle 24.
Questa è Monocle 24.
A Paris, a Munique, a Berlim. Frankfurt.
Broadcasting around the world, around the clock. This is Monocle 24.
And that's all for this edition of The Briefing here in London. The programme was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Gaia Lutz and Ines Fresine. Our studio manager was Wei Donglin. For the next half hour, Gillian Tobias is going to be in the studio. She's bringing you more from our international playlist. She's continuing today's continental shift, that is. And after that, in about 30 minutes, we continue with the latest edition of The Bulletin with UBS. This programme, The Briefing, is back tomorrow. At the same time, also do not forget Midori House at 1800 London time and the Monocle Daily at 2200 London time as well. I am Marcus Hippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.